Hello, I'm Kevin Moore, and you're now listening to The Moore Show. For the next hour, I'll cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I'm joined by Ian Crane to discuss his research into a global conspiracy and his upcoming AV4 conference. So stay tuned, enjoy, and I'll be right back with Ian Crane.
Missed a show or a guest? Want to know more about The Moore Show and upcoming guests? Then log on to www.themoreshow.co.uk.
Midnight at the Oasis. Send your camel to bed. Shadows painting our faces. Traces of romance in our heads. Heaven's holding a hand. Slip off to a sand dune real soon. Kick up a little dust. Come on, cactus is our friend. He'll point out the way. Come on, till the evening ends. Till the evening ends. You don't have to answer. No need to speak. I'll be your belly dancer, prancer, and you can be my sheep.
You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm about to be joined by my guest, Ian Crane. Just a bit of background on Ian. He's an ex-oil field executive who now lectures and writes on various geopolitical issues, with particular focus on exposing the agenda of the New World Order. Ian is an independent researcher who is completely self-funded. The views expressed in his talks and DVDs are based entirely upon his personal knowledge and research. Ian, welcome to the show.
Kevin, thanks for the invitation.
Well, Ian, on today's show, we're going to sort of tie a number of threads together and obviously concentrate on your on AV4, the biggest truth event in the UK, which takes place next week. With these threads, Ian, we're going to discuss climate change, the credit crunch, media control. Would you say these all do thread together?
Without any shadow of doubt. I mean, they are all fundamental parts of the control mechanism. And I mean, we could throw in things like vaccinations and the recent swine flu scam. I mean, these are all part of, if you like, the pressure that is brought upon the human race, basically, to bow down to those who believe that they effectively have the right to rule us as their own personal global fiefdom.
And are you referring to what you call the New World Order there?
Yeah, the New World Order is a good sort of, if you like, collective phrase that encompasses the globalists. And the people who drive this, I mean, they are not of one nationality and not of one race or one creed, as we would recognize it. I mean, they identify themselves as globalists. I mean, there have been people who have been monitoring their activities, certainly for the last sort of 100, 150 years. So, you know, this is really nothing new.
Okay. I mean, what's the goals of the New World Order then, Ian?
The goal is effectively the total subjugation of what will remain of the human race. And when I say what will remain, I mean, unfortunately, these guys are, spelling their goals and objectives out in pretty much words of one syllable and putting in tablets of stone. And of course, here I refer to the Georgia Guidestones, which, as you can tell by their name, are located in Georgia in the United States. And they mysteriously manifested about almost 30 years ago now, in the early 1980s. And written on this henge, and it's a very large granite henge, in 12 modern languages and 12 ancient languages, are the goals and objectives of the New World Order. And, I mean, number one of those objectives states quite clearly that their goal is to reduce humanity to under 500,000 people. And then it goes on to say, in balance with nature. Well, you know, we are told that the global population right now is in the region of 7 billion. And here these guys are spelling out that they want to reduce the population to effectively 1/14 of that, down to 500 million. And you know, that's why, you know, there is a lot of suspicion amongst those who follow the activities of the New World Order, that, you know, the bird flu, the swine flu, AIDS before that, were all part of an agenda to reduce the population. And of course, you know, we can refer back to Henry Kissinger's infamous remark, you know, where he referred to many of the people on the planet as useless eaters.
I mean, wouldn't you say we're already heading towards a one-world government with the European Union, for example?
Well, the European Union is certainly intended to be a step towards that. And in fact, I addressed exactly this issue in the DVD that I produced on Codex Alimentarius. And the reason I was discussing Codex Alimentarius a few years ago was because, in my opinion, the Codex Alimentarius agenda is the template for establishing global legislation. And the way in which these guys plan to bring about the global government, I mean, they have a number of different strategies because, as we'll discuss in a second, you know, things are not going necessarily all their own way. But, first of all, you've got to come away from 192 sovereign nations. You know, 192 to one may seem like a tall order. But, you know, you've already got things like the World Trade Organization, which has something like 160 countries under its auspices. And, you know, the World Trade Organization establishes regulations and directives and expects every member country to abide by those regulations and directives. But coupled with that, what we've had is, whilst the EU has been emerging over the last 60 years or so, we also see, we have the Asia-Pacific Economic Community, the League of African Nations, the League of Arab Nations, and, of course, in 2007, I believe it was, the legislation was signed in the US, Canada, and Mexico, paving the way for the North American Union. Which ultimately, the game plan is to merge the North American Union with the European Union, thus forming the North Atlantic Union, and that would bring together, say, 350 million Americans, you know, about 60, 70 million Canadians, I think it's about 150 million Mexicans. You know, coupled with the European population, and that puts together a trade and population bloc that is on par with China and India.
You know, is the end goal, is it more control on us?
Totally. I mean, without any shadow of doubt. And of course, we see a lot of this going on right now in terms of, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I mean, over the last few years, you know, we had people lulled into this false sense of financial well-being, which was basically, you know, Gordon Brown's, you know, we're beyond the days of boom and bust, we've only got boom. Well, you know, boom is perhaps an apt phrase because, you know, the vast majority of people perhaps still believe that between 2003 and certainly the end of 2007, that, for example, property in this country was rising at a phenomenal rate of knots. Many people think the stock market was rising at a phenomenal rate of knots, that we were in, you know, one of the most unprecedented bull markets ever known. But in reality, when you compare the rises in property and the rises in the stock market with the rise in the price of gold, which is the true measure,
yeah,
then in reality what was happening was property was actually falling, as was the stock market.
Yeah, I mean, with the fall of the stock market and homes, for example, I mean, look at the negative equity in homes.
Yeah, and of course, people were lulled into borrowing more money. I mean, and I know an example locally of a family. They bought a house in 1996 for £40,000. So, you know, you think, well, they're in great shape. The only problem is that with the phenomenal ramp up in apparent value of property, and the massive, aggressive marketing by the banks and the building societies to encourage people to borrow against the perceived equity in their house. So this guy who bought his house for £40,000 in 1996, today has a mortgage on that house of over £300,000. And, I mean, you know, at the peak of the market, the property probably was worth about £360,000, maybe £380,000. But today, he'd be lucky to get $260,000, $240,000 for it. So the bottom line is, you know, the guy 13, 14 years ago was in great shape. You know, had he kept his spending within the parameters of his earnings, instead of supplementing his income with this, you know, false equity,
yeah,
he wouldn't be in this position. And this, of course, is a story that is repeated over and over again, as people have borrowed against the CDS in their house. And now, as the housing market really starts to correct itself, yet people are in negative equity. And, of course, we're seeing repossessions increase. We're
That's
seeing
right.
bankruptcies increase. And, you know, people are very much under the financial cosh. And, of course, when people are under the financial cosh, they become malleable.
Yeah, you know, again, reducing the freedom even more, you know, due to recession, because I suppose debt is, you know, it's a psychological, you know, downer, isn't it, in a sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you are enslaved. I mean, by the way, I mean, you know, few people realize that the translation of the word mortgage actually is death grip. You know, so, I mean, once again, you know, the agenda is spelled out in the linguistics here. So, you know, the real issue, obviously, is for people to try and, you know, rise above what's occurring. And, you know, that's why, you know, many people are moving to get themselves off grid, you know, to get away from the lifestyle that is created by, you know, the materialist media. Because a consumer society needs consumers. So even although the money isn't there, you know, the industrial military complex is desperately trying to find ways to create momentum for buying. And that's why, you know, phenomenal sums of money were thrown into the US and the British and many European economies. It's called quantitative easing, which means putting extra money in there so that you know, the money can be made available, it can be spent, and thereby stimulate the economy. But in doing so, it's actually just delaying the problem, because it, in the process, it's creating more debt. So, in my opinion, you know, we saw the start of the crash in August of 2007 with the collapse of Northern Rock, and you know, that was followed sometime later by the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Unbeknown to many people in the UK, you know, many small banks in the US have collapsed or been absorbed by the larger banks. Many of the credit unions have collapsed in the US. And I think we're about to see I think across the world right now, sometime probably between April and October, sometime through the summer months, I think we're going to see a very serious global financial meltdown. I mean, if people think that in 2008 we had a financial crash, they ain't seen nothing yet. And this is really the same template that occurred in the 1930s. So you know, we shouldn't be too surprised. You know, what you read in the media, you'll see people talking about the threat of the double dip. Well, they have to do this because, you know, I predicted, as did many, many other people, that, you know, the world was about to hit, a financial brick wall. And fortunately, I recorded a presentation called Fool Me Once in July of 2007, where I spell out, you know, what was about to happen. And so, you know, if I saw it, and many other researchers saw it, you can bet your bottom dollar that the guys at senior level in the banks and in government also saw it coming. And now they know that the second hit is about to happen, and they're not going to get away by saying, oh, we could never have seen this coming along like they did the first time. They're not going to get away with that twice. So now they've actually got to lay it out and say, look, you know, there is the risk that it's going to happen. Well, I'd say it's more than a risk. It's an absolute certainty.
Yeah, I mean, the only way forward for people really is to stay away from credit cards. You know, just pay with cash, isn't it?
Absolutely. And live within their means, you know, whatever those means might be. More and more people are moving away from perhaps what we might term traditional employment, i.e., you know, being a wage slave. And more and more people are moving towards, you know, self-employment. And perhaps having multiple income streams. So instead of relying on an employer for a monthly salary check, you know, they're now perhaps doing a number of different things and have income coming in from, various quarters, so that, you know, they're actually not quite so exposed to the threat of, say, a company suddenly collapsing and being made redundant.
Yeah, I mean, in this time of depression, if you want to call it one word for it, you know, many young people right now, you know, it's been drived in them to sort of go to university, you know, get into debt, you know, but some of these degrees that some of these younger people are studying, they don't seem to be the best. And, you know, what's the objective for the students to sort of get into debt? Is it just more control for them in
totally.
A sense?
I mean, again, I mean, this strategy that was implemented by the Blair government in 1997, I mean, as soon as Tony Blair came into power, he introduced student loans. And the whole objective was, because he talked to education. So, you know, phenomenal numbers of university places were created at the universities and, you know, the old polytechnics. And in all sorts of weird and wonderful subjects. And the reality was that many of those subjects were, you know, perhaps interesting, but would they actually serve to helping that person get a career or get a foothold on a career? And the answer is, in many cases, no. But the objective wasn't really about education at all. The objective was to get the young people into debt. And you've got a crazy situation today, you know, where young people are almost taking any job they can get rather than sort of waiting until they find the right job, just to try and stave off this millstone that's around their neck.
Well, yeah, I mean, because they have to get to a certain point after the degree finishes where they have to start paying it back. I mean, and I know plenty of my friends, you know, who have finished university, and you know they've just gone for any job which is not even related to the degree. So...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, previously, a student or a graduate, you know, would try and obviously get a job straight after completing the college course, but then, you know, more recent times perhaps they've had to wait, you know, 3-4 months or whatever before the right job has come along. But now, you know, they're not even bothering. I mean, they're just saying, okay, I'll just go out and do bar work or whatever. We've really got a bit of a problem. I mean, you know, we're losing our manufacturing base again by design. You know, we've built an economy based on financial services, which we no longer fundamentally control, because obviously we're now part of the EU, thanks to the ratification of the Treaty of Lisbon. So, you know, I think we are really heading for, how should I say, almost a trauma, a situation where we're going to have massive trauma, because we're going to have financial meltdown, we're going to have economic meltdown, we're going to have employment meltdown, you know, and something is going to have to come in its place. And, you know, we may have to literally have a complete rethink about the way in which our economy functions.
You look at other countries, yeah, and some of these countries aren't in as bad debt as we are. I mean, we are in a pretty bad state. And again, some of these countries that are debt-free, they're called the axis of evil.
That's exactly correct. That's because they've managed to keep themselves out of the clutches of the World Bank. I mean, the World Bank has pursued an agenda. And if anybody really wants to take a look at how this works on a detailed basis, then the book that I would recommend is The Economic Hitman by a guy called John Perkins. And John Perkins recounts his earlier life where he worked on behalf of the World Bank. And his job was effectively to persuade developing countries to borrow money at outrageous rate calls, to establish infrastructure projects or other industrial projects, but basically, obviously, to get them into debt so that effectively the World Bank had a hold over them. And nowhere has this been more obvious than Dubai. Now, you know, as it happens, 20 years ago, I was living in Dubai, and I mean, it was a fast-growing city back then. But I mean, today it's completely unrecognizable to me because you know, it still had an element of quaintness about it. I mean, now it's just gaudy beyond belief. But what was happening was the ruling family, Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum, was baited, if you like, into borrowing outrageous sums of money for all these projects like the map of the world that was built offshore, Palm Island, you know, massive, massive building projects, all built on fiat currency. And then, of course, come the crunch, it all dries up. And in fact, Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum actually had to get bailed out by his neighbor in Abu Dhabi. And it's an abject lesson in overstretching on the macro basis.
Yeah.
So, you know, what effectively happened to Dubai was like every credit card you've got being totally maxed out. You know, basically in that situation, you're in a desperate situation. And of course, you know, basically you will do whatever it is the banks or your creditors ask you to do. And this is the way that the World Bank works with developing nations.
With the AV4, one of the sort of top subjects there is obviously going to be climate change, or, you know, global warming, if you want to call it that. Is this just another way of controlling us again as a general public?
Oh, totally. I mean, we have the evidence to show that, I mean, the whole man-made global warming mythology goes back to the 1960s. And we can actually trace a very early reference to that in a document called the Report from Iron Mountain, which many people try and dismiss as a forgery. But if it is a forgery, it's a bloody good one, that's for sure. The full title of the report, and of course your listeners can actually access this report for themselves. They can just go online and Google Report from Iron Mountain, and they can find the PDF version of it. The full title is Report from Iron Mountain on the Possibility and Desirability of Peace. Well, let me tell you that their bottom line, just to cut to the quick, their bottom line is that they actually come to the conclusion that, you know, really peace isn't desirable at all and it's better to have war. I mean, there's a classic statement on page 34 of the report where it says, "Why is war so wonderful? Because it creates artificial demand, the only kind of artificial demand." And they acknowledged that, and this, bear in mind, this is the 1960s, that the stock market is threatened by outbreaks of peace. You know, and they quoted from the Wall Street Journal, And the quote is, Wall Street was shaken yesterday by news of an apparent peace feeler from North Vietnam, but swiftly recovered its composure after about an hour of sometimes indiscriminate selling. You know, the threat of peace breaking out scares the stock market because it reduces the demand, particularly, obviously, from the armaments suppliers. But in this document, where they're looking at alternatives to war, let me just quote a little piece here. It says, nevertheless, an effective political substitute for war would require alternate enemies, some of which might seem equally far-fetched in the context of the current war system. It may be, for instance, that gross pollution of the environment can eventually replace the possibility of mass destruction by new weapons as the principal apparent threat to the survival of the species. Poisoning of the air and of the principal sources of food and water supply is already well advanced. I mean, just take that into account. Poisoning of the food and water supply is already well advanced.
Yeah.
And at first glance, this would seem promising. It constitutes a threat that can be dealt with only through social organization and political power. But from present indications, it will be a generation to a generation and a half before environmental pollution, however severe, will be sufficiently menacing on a global scale to offer a possible basis for a solution. And when they talk about offering a possible basis for a solution, of course, what they're talking about is creating the perception of a massive threat where, and as was later reported or quoted by the Club of Rome in 1992, where they said humanity then becomes the enemy of itself, and thereby, obviously, we turn on each other. And let me come back to remind me to talk to you about the Audi advert that appeared in the recent Super Bowl in the US. But, you know, what we're talking about here is absolutely a control mechanism. And, you know, the point where they say, this is 1967, it will take a generation to a generation and a half before it creates sufficient traction to really be usable. Well, guess where we're at right now? Effectively, it's a generation and a half since that report was written. And, you know, what a lot of people are not aware of is that the Copenhagen summit of last December had really very little to do with dealing with pollution. It was all about establishing a new economy based on carbon trading called the cap and trade system. And you know, this was a wonderful piece of synchronicity because the release of the ClimateGate emails just a couple of weeks before Copenhagen took all of the impetus away from the Copenhagen summit. So instead of the globalists going to Copenhagen with a game plan for effectively establishing global governance to deal with this threat of anthropogenic global warming, man-made global warming, and to replace the existing debt-based economy with a carbon trading system, had the rug pulled from under it. And, I mean, for even people who haven't taken the time or had the opportunity to review the emails that were released, you know, will have understood that basically the scientists of the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, were effectively prostituting themselves to the billions of dollars that were on offer, provided they came up with evidence and scientific statements to support this agenda of promoting man-made global warming. And the best summary I have found of the ClimateGate emails is written by a PhD in physics, a guy called John P. Costella. And this document, which is about 150-odd pages, but it's an excellent summary of the emails that were released. And the website to download this is www.assassinationscience.com/ClimateGate. And then you can download the PDF document. And, I mean, even if you don't read the document from end to end, you will find extracts from the emails written by the leading scientists who were at the forefront in promoting the global warming agenda. You can see the magnitude of the lies and the deception and the cover-ups that they were perpetrating, and the demonizing of anybody in the scientific community who had the audacity to suggest that the evidence was not sound, that there was an alternative viewpoint. You know, we've all heard the likes of Al Gore saying, you know, the science is settled. Well, it's very evident that the science isn't settled and was never settled, but it was just being suppressed.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about some people's views that we are warming this planet up and, you know, we could be making a difference?
Well, hey, listen, I mean, I think that you have to take a look on this sort of holistic basis. I'm not a climate scientist, but, you know, we've got David Bellamy speaking at AV4, and David Bellamy spoke at AV2 a year ago. And, you know, I mean, David was regaling us with the tales of how his, you know, career had been brought to an early termination, his media career in particular, purely because he refused to toe the party line on wind farms and anthropogenic global warming. But, you know, full credit to the guy. He stuck to his guns. I mean, he held the integrity. And, you know, the release of the ClimateGate emails have shown that, you know, David Bellamy and others like him, you know, really had a point. And they, you know, certainly not have been demonized as global warming deniers. You know, we have Johnny Ball speaking. Now, Johnny Ball, to many people, you know, probably particularly those between the ages of 20 and 45, you know, Johnny Ball, in many cases, was Mr. Science. You know, he was the guy who introduced maths and science, you know, to a generation on children's TV.
That's right, yeah.
And Johnny Ball is absolutely mortified at what he perceives to be the greenwashing that's going on in schools. You know, where effectively, instead of encouraging the next generation to develop their intellectual curiosity, you know, to develop the ability to question everything, you know, basically they're being browbeaten in being told that, you know, there is no alternative but to believe the dogma of global warming, and therefore, you know, man is responsible for poisoning the planet. But now when you look at, you know, a lot of the other information that's out there, we have another speaker, a guy called Peter Taylor, who has worked with Greenpeace. He's been an advisor to the United Nations, including the IPCC. And Peter Taylor is the author of a book called Chill. And Peter, for some years now, has made quite a compelling case to show that actually far from global warming, you know, we're actually about to enter a period of global cooling, which, you know, may actually be of more concern than global warming. But his point is that it is not humanity that is causing this. I mean, this is part of the natural climatic cycle. You know, it's related very much to solar activity, sunspot activity, and other, you know, planetary influences. And a man's influence, I mean, actually, for man to believe that, you know, we can destroy the planet like this is in some ways incredibly arrogant.
Ian, we're going to take a break there, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
To connect with the show, email kevin@themoreshow.co.uk. You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm currently joined here with our guest, Ian Crane. Ian, just before the break there, I was going to sort of move the subjects on to food. Does food affect our behaviour?
Most definitely. I mean, food and drink and the water. I mean, even the, you know, the fluidization of water is also, you know, part of the control mechanism. You know, I mean, it is embarrassing that many people who work in the health industry are still taken in by the mythology that fluoride prevents tooth decay. I mean, it's a wonderful piece of mythology that, again, has been rammed down people's throats for some 30, 40 years. But in reality, fluoride is a poison. I mean, fluoride was used by the Soviets and the Germans, the Nazis, in the Second World War. And it was put into the water of the prison camps because it kept the prisoners docile. In fact, there's been a very long-running court case in North America, in New Mexico. I don't think this court case will ever come to a decision.
Yeah.
Because it can't, basically. Because what you've got is you've got the families of former inmates of the New Mexico State Penitentiary who have claimed that their kin have been poisoned whilst they've been guests of the state penitentiary, because, you know, they've gone in with one personality and come out, you know, something completely different. And the claim is that this is because of fluoride, excessive fluoride, being put in the water supply. And now, you know, in terms of food, you know, over the last 30 years, we have literally gone from pretty much zero GM foods in the food chain to a situation today where in North America almost all of the soy crop is GM. And we don't fully appreciate yet the implications of what's occurring here. I mean, Dr. Arpad Putzai is the guy who is the real hero. Dr. Arpad Putzai was a researcher, a very, very well-regarded researcher at the Rowett Institute in Scotland. He spent 30 years as a researcher there, and his speciality was looking at foods. And in 1998, having initially been an advocate of GM foods, but then having conducted his own research where he found that the GM food was actually having a very serious negative effect on the stomach linings of young rats. And of course, he extrapolated that and basically determined that the GM foods were poison. And he went on a BBC documentary, I think it was World in Action.
Yeah.
And he stated that basically GM foods were unsafe and should never, never be permitted to enter the human food chain. Well, Monsanto caught wind of this, and so Monsanto called Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton called Tony Blair. Tony Blair called the head of the Rowett Institute, and Dr. Arpad Putzai was sacked. And as he says himself, he went from a 30-year career where he was regarded as one of the most important scientific researchers in this field to nothing. And in fact, tragically, he had a stroke this time last year. But his wife and partner, Dr. Susan Bardosh, who's a nutritionist who also works at the Rowett Institute, is carrying on his work. She works out of the University of Budapest. And she came over to AV2 last year and presented both her paper and Arpad's paper on the dangers of GM foods coming into the food chain. And, you know, the real big question is, now they're in, can we ever get them out? Well, Monsanto has their way, then no, they not only will they not come out, but ultimately all food will be GM. And Monsanto has adopted some horrendous tactics, like encouraging farmers on the west coast of America and Canada to plant GM crops, knowing full well that the trade winds blowing from west to east would then contaminate the non-GM crops of other farmers downwind. And of course, the classic case here was one of Percy Schmeiser, where actually Monsanto tried to sue him for illegally growing their GM crops when the seed actually just blown onto his land from a GM farm upwind. And they tried to bankrupt Percy Schmeiser because Percy was not taking it lying down, and ultimately he fought and won. But just to give you a perspective of where this is headed and the power of the likes of Monsanto and the biotech industry, when the Iraqi government, the fledgling Iraqi government, was forced to accept a constitution that had been prepared by the US government with the participation of some British academics, and Article 81 of that Iraqi constitution specifically forbids Iraqi farmers from saving their seeds.
Yeah. That's
horrendous.
I mean, this is the problem with the GM crops. I mean, as I understand it, I mean, all the nutrition's are being sucked out of it, would you say?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, who rides the rescue? You know, what we're having is we're getting food stuff, GM foodstuffs with the nutritional value greatly reduced. I mean, the minerals are being sucked out, the vitamins are being sucked out. So consequently, people end up eating stuff that really is not much better than cardboard. And so many people in the U.S. resort to food supplements. But what's happening is that the pharmaceutical industry, and this is part of the Codex Alimentarius agenda, the pharmaceutical industry rise to the rescue and says, well, actually, you know, we can produce these food supplements synthetically. So, and we make a hell of a lot more money when we produce things synthetically because we can patent it. So what we're going to do is we're going to do everything we possibly can to effectively make natural supplements, natural vitamins, natural mineral supplements, make them illegal, or make them so ineffectual that taking them has absolutely no health benefit whatsoever, and force people to buy the synthesized versions. And this is what is happening. I mean, again, this is the DVD that I recorded two and a half years ago, on Codex Alimentarius, where I said that all of this was going to happen because I researched what had occurred in the previous 15, 20 years. And I said, look, when we extrapolate this into the future, where we're heading here is a situation where the biotech industry and the pharmaceutical industry has a combined agenda to completely eradicate all organic farming, all natural farming, and replace it effectively with bioengineered crops. Coupled with which, the pharmaceutical industry is determined to completely destroy the complementary and alternative healthcare industry. I mean, we see evidence of this at the moment with the recent discussion in the House of Commons on homeopathy, where the motion was tabled that homeopathic remedies should not be administered by the NHS. And clearly, you have people who are totally in the thrall of the pharmaceutical industry and cannot extend their thinking to perceive the possibility that natural medicines, which, my God, have been around for thousands of years, could actually benefit the individual. And instead, we have to resort to these synthesized pharmaceuticals, which have only been around for 150 years or so, because that's where the pharmaceutical industry makes money.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you throw in the vaccines, and what we're really getting to is generations now. For the coming generations, are going to instead of enjoying a full, healthy life based on eating natural foods and being able to take natural medicines if the needs arose, are now effectively told that the only thing that's worth eating is the junk food, which inevitably is going to have an impact on their health. They go to the doctor. The doctor prescribes the pharmaceuticals, and the pharmaceutical industry is making out like bandits.
You mentioned this name, the Codex Alimentarius. Now, I understand that's Latin for food code.
That's actually correct, yeah.
Yeah, is your agenda with them that they want to remove the labelling on the food?
Oh, without any shadow of doubt. In fact, there's a meeting coming up in Canada at the beginning of May, and I'm trying to work my schedule so I can actually go along and either participate in this meeting as part of the National Health Federation team, or at the very least sit in the gallery, because this is a fundamentally important meeting, because Canada hosts the Food Labelling Committee of the Codex Alimentarius Commission. The Codex Alimentarius Commission is made up, it works under the auspices of the World Trade and World Health Organization, but it's made up of 27 different committees dotted all around the world, hosted by different countries, and Canada hosts the Food Labelling Committee. And there are moves, particularly by the US, to abolish the requirement for food labelling. Now, this is being driven by the biotech industry, because basically they don't want people to know whether they're eating organic food or GM food or cloned meat. I mean, they just want to label it as like meat, because they use the phrase substantial equivalence. And their argument is that because it's substantially equivalent, then, you know, it should all be classified as the same thing, i.e. meat is meat is meat is meat. But we know it's not, because, you know, for example, Europe right now refuses to import beef from the United States. And all beef, or most beef in the United States, is contaminated with the growth hormone, which is known as Posilac. And this beef, not being imported into Europe, means that the European community has to pay the World Trade Organization a fine of 150 million euros a year. I mean, you know, consider how outrageous this is. You know, we're paying a fine of 150 million euros a year purely to keep our beef at least free of growth hormones. And this is like a taxation. And, you know, I would actually argue that it's almost deliberate, you know, because the World Trade Organization demands that every World Trade Organization member country imports this contaminated beef. They know some won't, like Europe, and so, oh, hey, we're just going to fine 150 million.
Well, it's just like henchmen, isn't it, in a sense? It's just, henchmen of the UN, I suppose you can call it.
Exactly. So the whole Codex Alimentarius agenda, which, as you rightly say, means food code, and yet you will never see this phrase mentioned in the British media. I mean, you can read articles probably almost every day in the national papers which will discuss food and the benefits of food, or the merits of organic food, or the fact that non-organic food is you know, no worse for you than organic food, etc., etc. But you will never see the phrase Codex Alimentarius, and it's almost like there is an agreement not to mention this agenda, lest people actually start to investigate it for themselves and see that, you know, this agenda, which has been pushed for nearly 50 years, because the Codex Alimentarius Commission was established in 1962, and these guys aren't going to stop. I mean, for 50 years they've managed to keep their activities under wraps. And that's why so few people have heard about Codex Alimentarius. But, fortunately, more and more people are starting to question what's occurring here. But my concern is, if people don't wake up to what's occurring, then, you know, 20 years down the road, you know, you may have a situation where it's nigh on impossible to purchase organic food. I mean, even today in the US, a retailer can classify something as organic if it has up to 10% contamination. Mm. In Europe at the moment, it's 0.16%. So, I mean, basically, in the US, a product that's got 100 times the contamination of a product in Europe can be still called organic. And I'll give you a classic example. You buy a pint, or a litre rather, of organic milk in Europe, and it's got a shelf life of maybe 3-4 days. You buy a pint or a quart of organic milk in the US, and it's got a shelf life of a month.
And again, you know, let's go back to the agenda here. The agenda here is control the food, you control the people, would you say?
Well, that's actually a direct quote from Henry Kissinger, because Henry Kissinger famously said, back in the 1970s, he said, control the oil and you control nations, control the food and you control the people.
But would you also say that, you know, the food companies get you ill, maybe, and the pharmaceutical companies keep you ill?
Exactly, exactly. And, I mean, that's actually the title of Scott Tipp's presentation at AV4. It was the title of his presentation at AV2, which was Making Sickness Compulsory.
Yeah.
And Scott Tipps is the president of the National Health Federation, which is based in the US, but it's actually an international organization now. And the National Health Federation is the only organization representing the consumer, sitting with the opportunity to sit in and participate in the Codex Alimentarius Commission meetings. And, you know, Scott would readily acknowledge that all he can do is slow the process down, because the only thing ultimately that he's going to stop it is people actually waking up and realizing what's occurring and just basically, you know, voting with their wallets. I mean, if people stopped buying all the junk in supermarkets and demanded organic food produce, we'd see a change. I mean, I'll give you an example of that. I live in South Devon, and Totnes, the Morrisons in Totnes, has the highest percentage of revenue of organic food produce of any Morrisons in the UK. Now, when Morrisons in Totnes actually took over Safeways, initially, for a few days, they didn't have any organic produce there. And people were just not coming into the shop. They were going elsewhere to get their organic produce. So Morrisons actually had no choice but to start bringing in organic produce. And today, you know, the Morrisons at Totnes, as I say, has the largest percentage of revenue from organic produce of any Morrisons store. But you go 10 miles up the road to Newton Abbot and you try and buy organic produce, and it's really tough to find it. So it's very much dependent on, you know, people within the community trying to raise awareness amongst their friends, their family, their colleagues, as to what's occurring. And then when you go into the store, asking where the organic produce is. You know, yes, you do pay a little bit extra, but you pay a little bit extra because, unfortunately, obviously the demand isn't as great as for the other stuff. But if more and more people started demanding organic food, then, you know, that would obviously start to become the norm as opposed to the other stuff.
Now, you wanted me to remind you about the Super Bowl advert. Now, we've probably moved on from that subject, but what was the Super Bowl advert about?
Oh, yeah, the Super Bowl advert. You can see this. People can find this on YouTube for themselves. But if you Google Audi and Super Bowl, you'll find the 90-second YouTube advert, which basically has the green police. And, you know, it's all about if anybody's doing anything that's considered not green, they're basically arrested. And, of course, the punchline is that the Audi is super green and, therefore, the driver is left unmolested by the green police. But when you look at the ad, it, tragically, what you're looking at might become rather prescient, because, you know, this is exactly the type of agenda that the globalists, you know, want to establish, where they create this sort of mythology, if you like, that, you know, humanity is the enemy of itself by using all of these non-green materials. But take a look at the advert. Audi, just Google Audi and Super Bowl.
Now, next week, you've got the Biggest Truth event in the UK taking place on March the 26th, 27th and 28th. Now, this is taking place in Heathrow. Just explain to the listeners a bit about AV4.
Okay, well, obviously, AV4 stands for Alternative View 4. The reason being, it's the fourth event that we've run of this nature. The first one we ran 2 years ago, which started out in South Devon, in Totnes, primarily, actually, to raise awareness of the Codex Alimentarius agenda. And we had the likes of Philip Day and Dr. Robert Verkirk, who's the chief executive of the Alliance for Natural Health, amongst the speakers. And then a year ago, we had AV2, and this was very shortly after the swine flu scam broke. and we had Dr. Leonard Horovitz as our headline speaker. And Dr. Leonard Horovitz is the author of an outstanding book called Emerging Viruses and Bioterrorism. And you know, he gave an outstanding presentation and looked at the sort of history of the scams, if you like, that had been launched upon humanity to sort of create a revenue stream for the pharmaceutical industry through vaccines. And interestingly, of course, that one certain Donald Rumsfeld is a common denominator in a hell of a lot of things. Like, I mean, Rumsfeld was the chief executive of Searle when aspartame was put into the food chain. He was the chief executive of Gilead Pharmaceutical when it developed Tamiflu. And, of course, he was Secretary of State for Defense when the bird flu scam broke, the first bird flu scam broke in 2003, I think it was. And he made out very nicely on the increase in stock price. But you know, what we try and do is we try and bring along speakers who are leaders in their respective fields. I mean, not only would we have had Leonard Horovitz, we would have had Dr. Arpad Puzai, but as I said, unfortunately he had a stroke. But his wife and partner, Dr. Susan Bardosh, came over. And of course we had David Bellamy. And then we had AV3 in Bristol in November. And although this is only 4 months after AV3, basically, we decided that you know, election coming up in the UK, not that it's particularly meaningful anymore, but with the election coming up in the UK, you know, we wanted to draw as many key activists as we could from around the UK. I mean, the AV events are not just about the speakers. It's not just about the lectures. I mean, that's an important part of it, and it creates subjects for discussion and food for thought. But what's most important is about creating an environment where 300-plus independent thinkers can come together, meet with like-minded people, you know, share their insights, and also share their ideas for, you know, how we go out and spread the word and encourage people to take a look at what's going on for themselves. You know, one of the things that I and many of my colleagues always state is that, you know, we don't expect anybody to take anything that we say at face value. There's no need to, because, you know, thanks to the power of tools like Google in particular, you know, people can go and check everything that we say for themselves, and we encourage them to do so, because at the end of the day, you know, you can't tell somebody the truth. The truth actually has to be realized by the individual for themselves.
Okay, well, look, Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you very much indeed.
To find out more on Ian Crane, go to www.iancrane.co.uk. And don't forget the conference for Ian's Alternative 4. To see him and other great guests live, go to www.av4four.co.uk. Well, from myself and all my guests, thanks for listening.